This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly session in which we answer your questions. We call it Q&A with Layla. That's because my co-host on these episodes is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, logically enough, because that's the way we work together at the Hoffman Center. We use a team approach to work with patients. I'm on the medical side, and Layla's on the nutritional side. Although, Layla, I might say I do dabble in nutrition here and there, don't I?
Oh, you certainly do. You're a certified nutritionist.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
But you know, it comes down to the nuts and bolts, the nitty gritty, and you know, specific implementation plans. That's where your expertise lies. So this week we'll answer questions. But before we get to questions, by the way, the way to get to questions to us is via radio program at AOL.com. Send your questions to that email. And if we select your question, read it on the air, you'll get an answer if you listen to the podcast. And presumably you're savvy, because if you're already listening, you know how to find our podcasts. You can get them at drhoffman.com. You can subscribe to them on Stitcher. You can subscribe to them on iTunes, and they'll be delivered to your mobile device or computer. So before we get to our questions, Layla, one of the big stories that I posted this week, or actually I posted last week, has to do with an individual named Dr. Julie Geberding. Dr. Julie is the former director of the Centers for Disease Control. Headline, former CDC director Julie Geberding sells 38,368 shares of Merck stock for $2.3 million.
Oh, conflict of interest, big time.
That's right. I mean, how many patients would we have to see to make $2.3 million at the Hoffman Center? Hey, I'm not jealous. I enjoy what I'm doing, but, you know, reputation is everything. And, you know, there seems to be a little bit of a conflict of interest. And I'll read the story here. Julie Geberding was in charge of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from 2002 to 2009, which include the years that the FDA approved the Merck Gardasil vaccine. Soon after she took over the CDC, she reportedly completely overhauled the agency's organizational structure. Many of the CDC's senior scientists and leaders either left or announced plans to leave. There was a changing of the guard. Some have claimed that almost all of the replacements that Julie Geberding appointed had ties to the vaccine industry.
Now, here's not just the pharmaceutical for medicine, but the vaccine industry.
Now, check this out.
Wow.
Dr. Geberding resigned from the CDC on January 20th, 2009, and she got a new job. What do you think her new job was?
Oh, wait. She's in a pharmaceutical company overseeing vaccines or something.
Bingo. Now, you didn't read the story, but, you know, good guess.
I didn't read the story. No, I didn't.
She took over as president of...
Oh, wow. Where did you post it?
I posted this on Facebook. She took over...
Oh, yeah. I don't do Facebook. Right.
You're a non-believer. You're a Luddite.
I'm a non-believer so far in Facebook, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. So...
We're not surprised, are we?
Yeah.
Not about Facebook, but about Geberding.
Exactly. So she took over as president of Merck's vaccine division, and now she is the executive vice president of Merck. She just sold $2.34 million worth of her Merck stock. But don't worry, because she still has 31,985 shares of the company's stock valued at about $2 million. So, you know, what this illustrates is that there's, I mean, really a revolving door. And some people might say, what's wrong with that? Because, you know, she's an expert. She's a doctor who has been head of the Centers for Disease Control. That's very prestigious. Let her earn as much as she wants. But the Gardasil vaccine that was approved on her watch is somewhat controversial. I know that it's being pushed because the concern is that young women and young boys could get the HPV virus, and then the young girls could be at risk for cervical cancer. There's even some concern that the HPV virus may be implicated in some cases of rectal cancer or anal cancer, and also oral cancer. There's some people who are not smokers.
Oral cancer, yeah.
And they believe that it may be sexually transmitted as a virus causing. Okay, so I get it that there's a concern. But I have to say that there are incidences of severe reactions to this vaccine. And, you know, so that's how it works. I mean,
yeah.
You know, one hand washes the other.
And the other thing is, this is, again, the fox guarding the hen house.
Yes.
At the time when she was at CDC.
Right.
So, I mean.
And it seems like there are rewards there. So how can you make a very clear-eyed judgment about whether a vaccine is safe for the general populace when this huge windfall awaits you at the end of your government tenure? You know, this is traditionally the way that, you know, government employees, they don't make millions and millions of dollars. But you can be sure that after a period of government service, that you get, you know, swooped up by the private industries, whatever industry probably you were trying to regulate in your federal government role, and then you become, you know, an expert schmoozer so that the whatever industry that's being regulated by the government can front you out as a person to, you know, hammer out exceptions for your particular
yes.
either big pharma interest or, you know, whether it's a mining interest or whether it's an agricultural interest. I mean, that's mm-hmm. how that works.
That's how that works. And it's unfortunate. And all the lobbying that goes on, that has to stop. I don't think that will happen in our lifetime, but we'll see.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there you go. Okay. So, you know, case study in how mm-hmm. things get done at the regulatory level.
Right.
When it comes to what we believe are sometimes questionable vaccines. Okay, moving right along. We have some good questions today, so why don't you pose some of the questions?
We do. Now, we've got a very interesting one from Jean. Dear Dr. Hoffman, love your show, but I had to write after listening to Saturday's show, specifically the comments relating to red meat. There's an article that Jean has linked here on Medical News Today, a few months ago. It raises questions about the potential for a sugar that is found in red meat to cause widespread inflammation at best and cancer at worst. The authors do acknowledge the difficulty of extrapolating studies done in mice into humans,
well, just,
but they do raise the possibility that it can raise inflammation.
So just hold on for a minute. So what this is
yeah.
yet another study that shows a molecular mm-hmm. mechanism by which meat is bad for you. Meat might be bad for your heart.
Yes.
And it might be bad for cancer. However, you know, I looked at the study. You showed it to me before we did this broadcast. And the study is done in mice, mm-hmm. number one. And it's also done in mice who are genetically altered, so that they had an extreme vulnerability to this particular substance. And, mm-hmm. you know, so they use what are called knockout mice, who are, they're sort of specially bred.
They knock out, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're specially bred to be, shall we say, more dramatically susceptible to one or another disease or to one another environmental chemical, or in some cases to the effects of a drug. And this is sort of a unique artificial situation. And, you know, I one of the things I continuously say on this program is we've cured so many diseases in mice, and then, you know, we have mice who we sever their spinal cords and then we glue them together with some new miracle substance and they're walking again. But so far, it hasn't really translated to humans. So mice yeah. are different yeah. than us. You know, with a few exceptions. I mean, I think you probably know a few acquaintances or relatives who are part rodent. But for the most part, you know, so often they will have, for example, they'll do studies and they'll show that, you know, when we fed mice hamburger, they all got clogged arteries. Well,
right, or rabbits, because rabbits are really herbivores.
Yeah, that was the Anichkow study.
And they get, yeah.
That was the Anichkow study where they said, I think they served lard to rabbits or something like that. But rabbits don't, you know, when was the last time you saw a rabbit, you know, like a herd, like a whole flock of rabbits jump on a cow, massacre the cow, and then gnaw away at its fat? That's not a natural situation. So,
no.
You know, so is it applicable to humans? You know, I kind of doubt it. I think the best way that we can understand this phenomenon is to look at populations that consume lots and lots of chemical-free natural meat and see if indeed they have a higher risk of any types of diseases. I mean, that's the worthwhile comparison, and to see if this particular substance is the key to any problems they might have. And in fact, most studies looking at humans who consume a fairly high amount of animal protein don't show serious problems. But I mean, studies in America that show that people who eat a lot of meat, they have worse health than people who are on a plant-based diet. The reason is because eating indiscriminately and eating lots of meat in America is accompanied by other bad lifestyle habits. You know, they're less conscientious
like
about exercise.
Like drinking beer and smoking.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, it's like,
you know, they're eating meat in the form of a burger and fries.
Yeah.
So,
and so
not taking into account the fries and the other things, and exactly. So, I mean, even not even in grad school, but even in undergrad, I remember my professors, you know, driving the message home, you can't look at a rodent study and extrapolate this to humans. You can't take an animal study and extrapolate this to humans. We have to be very, very careful and scrutinize that carefully. So here we are.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, mice are cheap. They live for a short period of time. Everything is accelerated. You can see things happening within, you know, a few weeks or months that would take normally years or decades in humans. So they're a popular subject for research. And, yes, they're related to us because they're mammals, but very, very different types of metabolism. So, again, I think some people will utilize this argument. You know, the people who are zealous, you know, vegans or vegetarians may utilize this as yet another study that substantiates their view of the world that we should not consume animal protein because of this obscure mechanism that creates inflammation. But I'm not sure that is that relevant. And, you know, the other thing, you and I don't really call for massive consumption of animal protein. I think that's not really where we're coming from.
Not that much is needed, I mean, really, it's and it's as you said earlier. You know, the studies, the American studies, is anybody who is a consumer of meat is also lumped into that pile of a sedentary lifestyle, other risk factors such as obesity, smoking, alcohol use, or heavy alcohol use, any of those things. So
right, and simply overweight, because when you have unlimited food options. You tend to eat more. Mm-hmm. And if you restrict your diet very carefully and you say, well, you know, meat's off the table and I'm only going to eat plant-based food, you have restricted options. And so you're going to ultimately, in many cases, eat less. I mean, there are some obese vegans, but to a lesser extent than people who eat an omnivorous diet.
Yeah. And then there's the risk later on as they get older of sarcopenia, osteopenia, osteoporosis.
Right.
And all that goes with that, which
right.
is
so
worrisome.
We've been down this path before, you know, arguing the merits of a vegan or vegetarian diet versus an omni diet, Mediterranean diet. And, you know, we've sided with the latter. Okay. Well, interesting point.
Yeah. Thanks, Gene, for sending this to us so we can discuss it. Okay. Our next question comes from Ufe. Ufe says, used to ride my bike 20 miles per day, but, well, you know, the old prostate went nuts. Tried all kinds of different seats. Do you have a suggestion?
Yeah, as an inveterate bicycle rider, I'm very thankful that I don't have that problem. Uh-huh. And to some extent, uh-huh. it's anatomical. I think there's some people who just have a susceptibility to, positional pressure on their prostate. Other men may already have an enlarged or irritated prostate, and they feel it more. There's no question that these hard seats, they can be uncomfortable, and they take some getting used to. Sometimes after a cold winter, I haven't been on the bike, and I get the bike out, and that first ride, for an hour or an hour and a half, I call that a conditioning ride, and I'm, a little sore there, because people say, how do you sit on that narrow seat? And it's hard, too. It's not padded. But you get used to it, and then you accommodate it, and you maybe build up some tolerance, or you build up some padding.
Bicycle shorts
are very well padded, and they can be helpful. Mm-hmm. But there are also now anatomical seats. There really are seats that have virtual cutouts where you're actually sitting more on the hip bone, on what's called the ischial tuberosity, rather than putting pressure directly on your prostate, which is in the middle. Good bike stores and catalogs have these. And I think the only way to find out is to try and see what works best for you. So, hopefully your bike riding days aren't over. It just may be a matter of finding the right kind of seat. Padding, I find, is a little bit disappointing in terms of its benefits, because ultimately, you do get a little bit of shock absorption from the padding, but you still have to, there's still pressure on that area. And sometimes there's the bulk of the padded seat can be equally uncomfortable. I find the padded seats very annoying. Perhaps I'm used mm-hmm. to the hard, narrow seats on racing mm-hmm. bicycles, but I guess I'm lucky. That's one thing that I don't have.
Okay. Thank you for your question.
Right. Scientifically, I will tell you, there is this phenomenon. It's called pudendal neuropathy, which is a loss of sensation to the pudendal nerve, which is associated with sensation in the genitals. And that can be horrible uh-huh. because it can impair sexual performance and erection, and it can be a cause mm-hmm. of male impotence in inveterate bike riders. But this often occurs in super dedicated bike riders. I mean, there's a lot of concussion and vibration on rough roads, mm-hmm. It's a known condition, pudendal neuropathy. Similarly, bike riders sometimes get carpal tunnel syndrome from the vibration that occurs to the handlebars, and they get numbness, tingling, mm-hmm. loss of sensation sometimes to their fingers because of damage to the nerves in their hands. Riding a bicycle over and hitting bumps a lot, it's a little bit like operating a jackhammer, for your hands. But the main contact points are your hands, your butt, or your, in this case, your perineum, and your uh-huh, feet. Uh-huh. And you can get damage to your nerves in your feet from the concussion and pressure of pushing down on the pedals and the vibration. So there are some bicycle related syndromes that can develop.
Wow. That's fascinating, Dr. Hoffman. Wow. Okay. So our next question comes from Lisa. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, my daughter has been paying for the past 12 years for the storage of placenta blood following childbirth. Is there any evidence to support perpetually paying for this? It's about $100 a year. What do you think?
Well,
don't they save the placenta for stem cells, future stem cells, for that person, for that baby as they grow?
That is the idea. At the present time, saving saving the placenta, basically, with the prospect that eventually the stem cells can be harvested and used for repair later, is kind of a sci-fi proposition. It's a little bit like when Ted Williams had his head frozen, so that he could be revived later. It's not quite as way out as that. It's more plausible than cryogenics. But right now,
maybe the storage of placenta blood would that be used for a transfusion or something? Or
No. So the idea is that...
I can't imagine that's enough.
Yeah, no, the idea is that the placenta contains stem cells. The stem cells can then be reintroduced in the body and then coaxed to regenerate whatever you need to get regenerated. So say you have kidney failure, you know, and you want to regenerate your kidneys. And hopefully either a new kidney can be grown in a test tube for you or around some kind of biologically compatible scaffolding. They're already beginning to, do skin grafts with that. Like they can grow ears for people who've lost ears or noses. And they, you know,
wouldn't
they actually
be wonderful.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. But that's already being done. And it isn't necessarily dependent, in my opinion, on having placental stem cells saved. I think they can harvest a person's cells and then culture them and grow them in a certain way so that they'll replace skin structures. They can actually develop artificial skin that way. But
wow.
When it comes to complex organs, so far they haven't really come up with the way that tells the stem cells to become an eye or a liver or a kidney or brain, the most complex organ of all. And so so this is in its infancy. You know, there are doctors who are also sucking out the fat from people's bellies, and there's some stem cells there, and then they're re-injecting the stem cells in an IV after some sort of preparation into people's bloodstreams to, you know, to fix all and sundry kind of health problems. This is, you know, so far...
That's terrific. Get rid of belly fat. To take care of another problem.
Exactly. But yeah,
that's a win-win right there.
Totally. I mean, in principle, yes. But in actuality, there's scant evidence that these cells really take hold and regrow. And there's actually, I've read some articles recently where this is a concern to actual stem cell researchers because they see that there's like a real regulatory gap and there's kind of a gold rush mentality about using stem cells before the technology is even perfected. And so it's actually several articles.
It
one big article.
So promising.
I'm sorry?
It just sounds so promising.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it does. I mean, it's whole like a regenerative medicine kind of thing. And I think that in a decade or two or three, we'll have better technology to coax the stem cells to properly regenerate what they're targeting. But at present time, it's... you know, bridge too far. And so, you know, is it worthwhile? I mean, you pay a lot of money to have these stem cells stored. It's all speculative. It may be that, and this is sort of a trend, and, you know, you want everything for your kid. You want the best baby carriage. You want to put away some college funds for your kid. You want, you know, insurance policies, blah, blah, blah. And so, if, you know, for, you know, a storage fee of, I don't know, $100 a year or something, you may want to hedge your bets by storing some placental material so that future technology is available, it can, you know, be harnessed there. However, it's not entirely sure that you will need to use your own stem cells. It may be possible to use a general pool of stem cells or use, you know, something that's like derived from your bone marrow or from even your adipose tissue, from fat. So it's all kind of a crapshoot.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you know, price of 25 or 27 cents a day, it's probably not anything. So, wow.
Yeah, people spend $3 a day for their Starbucks. So,
yeah, exactly.
Right? So, compare.
The latte factor, yeah.
Okay, so...
Okay,
go ahead.
We have another question from Gabriella. Dr. Hoffman, you recently spoke about the possibility of using measles virus for treatment of certain cancer. Do you think that having had the measles might provide sort of an immunity or getting the vaccination? Is that a possibility?
The answer is plainly no, because the idea here was that through some complex high-tech process, they incorporated some sort of killing antibody into the virus. The virus is the Trojan horse, shall we analogize, that introduces this this unique killing principle into the body. And in this case, it was done, you know, under some sort of MRI guidance directly to parts of the brain where there's brain cancer. So it had to be targeted very specifically. They put the virus in there. There was an infection of the cancer cells with the virus. And then it wasn't the measles per se that chewed up the cancer cells. It was, you know, some sort of anti-cancer substance that was welded to the virus, so that you got, you know, and you got,
wow,
you know, sort of a like a guided missile effect to the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing this with other
so virus. They'd be useful.
Yes.
Wow.
Viruses are, and they have been used as viruses have been used as a way of introducing genes into the body in gene
as
modification.
A vector.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
that's fascinating too.
Yeah. So the measles. I mean, look, there are actually some ancient therapies that are called fever therapies where they used to give people, and this is actually. They've used this as an analogy. There used to be something called Coley's toxin. There was a guy around 1900 who noted that if you gave people experimentally an infection and they had a very high fever and their body had a profound immune reaction, that sometimes their cancer would disappear. And this became the basis for an alternative cancer therapy called Coley's toxins that was used quite a lot in the early 20th century. And so this is a more sophisticated, high-tech, refined variation on Coley's toxin. But it would be too indiscriminate to say, oh, yeah, you know, catch the measles, that'll make your cancer go away, or take a measles vaccine and your cancer will go away. That's
mm-hmm.
kind of a oversimplification of that. So, sorry, but, you know, it's promising.
Wow.
It's promising. All right, this is a good point at which to pause, because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. When we return, give us a preview of what we're going to hear in part two.
Oh, vitamin D is rat poison?
Ah, vitamin D has been used as rat poison. True or false?
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the annals of medical history to find out if that's the case.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. And we're answering your questions on our weekly Q&A with Layla. This is Intelligent Medicine.